This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rasslan, today we have the return of a member of the video making team here at BFM, Rahma Pauzi.
Glad that you got my name right. Hi.
And it's going to be clear why I'm having trouble with names today. Because we have here for the first time ever a theatre director and also producer and director of viral video content, Zalfian Fuzi.
Hello, thank you.
Now, I've known Zalfian for a long time, and whenever I'm thinking of your name, Rahma, I get your two names confused in my head.
No wonder you've been calling me Rahma Pauzi, and I'm like, it's Pauzi. What's so wrong about it?
It's so easy, because there's Fuzi, Pauzi.
Now I get it. So, okay, because just now when you introduced us, you said Zalfian Fuzi and Rahma Pauzi. Yeah.
Anyway, so our three topics this week are, topic number one is the Hadhrami, or Yemenis. Topic number two is a lunar calendar or lunar new year. And finally, topic number three is the fire festival and con people.
Yep.
So with topic number one, a few weeks ago, I recommended a book called Becoming Arab by Sumit K. Mandal about the Yemenis, or the Hadhrami, we should say more specifically, who have been migrating to this part of the world for many centuries. And I really want to talk about this today because it just so happens we have in the studio two members of that community.
Yes.
In Zalfian and Rahma.
Okay, yes.
And so we have the opportunity to put these two people under the microscope and discover who these people are. So I'm going to give a bit of context first. So since the 1500s, there have been people coming to the Indo-Malay world from Yemen. So Yemen is the southernmost part of Arabian Peninsula. And unlike the people further north in Mecca, Medina, for the Yemenis, or Hadhrami, I should say, from the valley of Hadhrami, their world looked toward the Indian Ocean. And so they were sea traders, and in small numbers, people came from there, men, specifically men, a handful of women, but almost entirely men, came to this part of the world, settled in places like Penang, less so Malacca, and more so in Singapore, but more so again in present-day Indonesia in towns like Medan, Pontianak, and Surabaya, acting as traders, as bankers, as shipping agents to trade in the Middle East. Many kind of roles that a lot of Chinese people took up as well, but trading more westwards as opposed to the Chinese going more eastwards. And when the Europeans came, specifically the Dutch, the Hadhrami trading world moved more inland. And so a lot of people became much more like landowners, agriculturalists, they weren't in the fields, but they were owning large tracts of land, and landlords, for that matter. So the book is really a wonderful book. And fascinating. I'd love to be able to talk about, you know, this community, not a huge community, but has succeeded very well.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, you two, do you have a sense of connection to your Hadhrami part? So, Rahma, for instance, how Hadhrami are you?
So this would go all the way back to, I think, my great-grandparents. So I think, I don't know, I probably have like one or two drops of Yemeni blood, as little as that. But there's this part on my dad's side. So my dad's from Penang, but his great-grandparents came from Yemen. Oh. But I don't think he came here as a trader, but he was more on that route, you know, for like scholarly, you know, trying to teach at Pondok school, things like that. And then what was so interesting is that we just got reconnected to this part of the family more, because apparently there's like this one lineage from there that is a lot more in touch with the Yemeni root. By, you know, after several generations, they would encourage their children to remarry a Yemeni, you know, just to strengthen the blood again, you know, because you've been like intermarrying with like the Malays and Chinese and all that. And then like after several times, and they're like, hey, I just so happen to have like, you know, to know this like third cousin of mine who is in Malaysia and has someone who's still not married, then are you interested? You know, and they're still doing that. And so we have like a few of our family, like really, really distant family members in Penang and Singapore. It's close to JB. And also some of them who used to be in Kelantan I think several decades ago, has moved out to Penang and Singapore.
So Zafian, you're nodding your head. You're probably related, aren't you?
Well, it's a small world, right? But no, I mean, the way you describe the history of the Yemeni migration here to Malaya back then is exactly my story. So my great-grandfather is was a trader, and he came here to trade back in the day, and he ended up marrying another wife, right? So he had a first wife in Yemen, and he married a Malay wife. And that's how my family started in, here in Malaysia. But what makes my history a bit different is that both my great-grandparents are both Yemeni.
Right.
So on both sides, coincidentally.
Yeah.
So my Malay-Yemeni connection is actually quite strong. And about 10 years ago, my grandmother went back to Yemen with my uncles to actually find the gravesite. Because he actually went back to die back in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. It was an amazing trip because they came back with all these photos and they were actually able to find the site, the gravesite, and they were also able to come back with a family tree, which was, you know, about, like, you know, 2 arms lengths wide of the family tree. And then they actually took all the photos of our, you know, distant relatives. And what's really interesting is when I saw the photos, I was really shocked because a lot of these people look like me. Right? So in Malaysia, people don't, you can't really tell. I mean, everyone's so mixed in Malaysia, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't really tell, are they mixed what, right? Are they Malay, Chinese, Indian, right? So it was really interesting for me to finally see people who look very similar to me, because I don't actually come across people who look, you know, quite like me. I mean, everyone's so unique, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really fascinating. So it's interesting that, you know, they were able to come back with that family tree and actually trace the roots of that. Do you know which clan you're from, Rahma?
I don't know. I only know this one last name, which I'm not sure if I'm like directly related to. Uh-huh. Is Al-Jashi?
Al is very so Al-Jafi.
Al-Jashi.
Jashi. So Jashi is where you're from, right? So Jashi area. So right. I'm Al-Yafi, from the Yafi area, right? So my family clan is an Al-Yafi clan. You're an Al-Jashi clan. So that the name will denote where you're from.
Is there bad blood between you two?
I'm not sure.
Some ancient vendetta is gonna suddenly happen.
Yeah.
Well, one last question then. Do you have a sense of specific cultural practices in your sort of family histories? I mean, what I mean is, like, you know, weddings or raya for that matter?
None in particular, but I think, like, what you were saying geographically, right? Penang.
Yeah.
So, like, your family as well, Rahma, is from Penang, right? So mine as well is from Penang. So a lot of the traders came to Penang and that's where they settled down. So a lot of family... my cousins, my father's fat side of his cousins, his aunties, uncles, and even from my mother's side, a lot of them are based in Penang. So Penang is a very strong connection for us. There's nothing particularly unique. I mean, we don't follow any sort of, you know, like the Saidzu or the Said must marry a Sharifa. We don't follow that type of thing.
Mm.
But I think other than that, nothing in particular, no.
Okay, well, I'll wrap this up with... I don't know, a little joke that I've been wanting to say for ages. So I've had the opportunity to meet public Yemeni number one and public Yemeni number two. So we move on, though, to topic number two. Rahma, Lunar New Year.
So this has been like at the back of my mind for like several years now. So I guess maybe Zafian is not aware, but I lived in New York for a couple of years. And so this was, I think, between the 2015, 2014 till like 2017. And of course, like one of the things that I gravitated towards to mostly was, you know, being with the international students there. And I was doing a documentary, and there's a bunch of like Chinese international students who end up doing documentary film for their masters. But one day they would say, "Hey, Rahma, do you want to go to Hot Pot?" And I said, "What for?" "Oh, it's Chinese New Year." And I'm like, "Oh, I've never thought about, like, you know, going to Hot Pot for Chinese New Year." Although, like, I kind of, like, I didn't really observe it, but I would always, like, you know, get invited to things when growing up in Malaysia. So the way it's celebrated is very unique. It's, okay, you would go out for steamboat, and that's, like, a way for you to celebrate Lunar New Year or Chinese New Year, as they called it. Several years later, like 4 years later, 5 years later. So one thing that I've been noticing is that a lot of my friends, American friends, most of them, also white, would end up celebrating Lunar New Year as a part of like a thing now, because they live in New York and there's a lot of hot pot places. They always have like good deals, and they're always like, "Oh, happy Lunar New Year." It's just like one of those things, you know, that get it's not appropriation, because I think it's fine. Like, I think it's more about, you know, just adding like another cost of celebrations for you to like, you know, to, sure. To have. So it's like holy festival. So that's because it's fine.
Yeah.
But then it got me thinking about other things. So that's just like a segue in like how that there are a lot of other communities around the world that celebrate. They don't say it's Lunar New Year, but a lot of the world, a lot of communities would observe a lunar calendar and celebrate something. So Mal Hijrah, for example, and I think a lot of South Asian communities, I think Ugadi and Gudi Padwa, Kashmiri New Year, Burmese New Year, Cambodian New Year, and these are all kind of like similar to Lunar New Year, Chinese New Year, but it would be observed like several weeks later or several weeks before or several months later.
But they're all on the lunar calendar.
Yeah, they're all lunar calendar. And I'm just like thinking about like how do we form our relationship with lunar calendar, because we are so entrenched with, you know, observing Gregorian calendar. Yeah. Where does it stop? Where does it end? You know, because like it's like still observed in certain ways, but you don't acknowledge it in your, you know, day-to-day life. So it's like you would only, you know, go to it when there's celebration. So I thought that's quite interesting.
But the Muslim Islamic calendar is a lunar.
It's also a lunar calendar.
The difference being with China, there's an inserted month, isn't there? There's an extra month that's sort of added so that it sort of hits.
I almost want to say it's kind of the same, but I'm not sure. Yeah, it's probably so it's so interesting. And like, because there's also a reason why, you know, several communities will celebrate the Lunar New Year close to Chinese New Year, because they use or utilize the lunar calendar the same ways. But for a lot of communities in Iran and Jewish communities, their New Year's is on different times and would happen at different times during, you know, one Gregorian calendar year. Mm. And that mostly because like the way you observe lunar calendar is also very different. So say, you know, it would end, you know, when there's no moon, and then, you know, there's like full moon, and then there's no moon again. Like the cycle is the same, but the way you count as like how many months would count as a year is also very different. So yeah. I thought that's interesting, but I also found something else, that stock prices and the way people invest and property valuation also change with lunar calendar based on a lot of scholarly articles.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So, yeah.
So the cycles there are lunar and not Gregorian.
And there's a lot of people who've been like doing research about this. And I was just wondering if you guys have something to share about lunar calendar, I guess.
I have to say that I don't feel... And I think it's a facet of being kind of like a modern human, that the lunar cycle doesn't seem so important. But it makes sense to create a calendar out of the moon, because that's the most obvious thing in the sky.
Yeah.
And you would create your calendar around it. But I wonder if in a land with seasons, it makes more sense to have a sort of more Gregorian style thing where your spring equinox is your midsummer is always at the same point. Whereas if you're in a more seasonless place, like, say, you know, the deserts of Arabia.
It would make sense.
You know, what does it matter?
Yeah.
I must say, when I first came back to Malaysia, I mean, I grew up in England. And so on rare occasions, I'd be in London, there'd be like suddenly Chinese New Year lion dances. Mm-hmm. And then came back to Malaysia, and how Ramadan keeps shifting around the year. Because, I mean, in England, no one notices it. Like, Ramadan was there.
Yeah.
How it keeps shifting around the year. And then how Chinese New Year sort of moves around ever so slightly.
Yeah.
And then the Gregorian calendar is the steady.
Yeah.
Very confusing. but you sort of go with the flow very easily, though.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But apparently also, just one last thing, it's slightly unrelated, but apparently Jewish people in America during Christmas time will go and have traditionally Chinese food. So their Christmas lunch, because they're Jewish, what are they going to do about Christmas? Mm. They're going to have Chinese food.
I wouldn't blame them.
Because the Chinese restaurants are open. Did you do anything spectacular this Lunar New Year, Rahma?
No, I'm just involved in a theater practice, so I've been mostly coming to rehearsals, which is still pretty nice.
Right. It'd be nice to be more in touch with the moon. But in a moment, though, we're going to come on to topic number three, where we're going to talk about con men. Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Rahma Fuzi. Oh my God, I got the name.
You
got
that on purpose. Okay.
Rahma and Zalfian. Let's just leave it at that. And now, topic number three, Zalfian, Fire Festival.
Yes. I don't know if some of you would recall, back in 2017, there was a huge, you know, social media phenomenon about this festival that was happening in the Bahamas in 2017. Why it's such an interesting story is because it was billed as a luxurious music festival that was full of, celebrities, influencers attending. They had like top artists that would be coming. They would fly people in private jets to land in the Bahamas on an island with like villas that they were building for people, with celebrity chefs cooking exotic food. So it was billed as the most famous and biggest luxury music festival. But it was a huge flop, right? The festival was a disaster, right? So the organizers and the CEO of the company from Fire Media, who was organizing this, is now been convicted for fraud and is currently in jail. And it was a huge PR disaster because, you know, they had people coming to this festival and nothing was ready. Right, so from a whole event management standpoint, there was like no food, there was no place for people to stay. People were stranded, like at the airport, they were locked. They didn't have any water. They had no beds. They were put in like disaster relief tents.
Oh my God. And these people spent a lot of money.
Well, yeah. Well,
yeah,
the thing is,
thousands, right?
Yeah, thousands, right? It was a huge festival on the scale of Coachella or some of these other big international festivals, right? And the artists canceled. And in the end, after the first night, they canceled the whole event. So people were left stranded and didn't have a way to get home, right? So this was trending on social media. So if you were following social media, I mean, this was just going berserk, right? And then, of course, there were a lot of whistleblowers within the company who were just releasing all sorts of different things on social media about how the CEO and his partner, Ja Rule, were just making a mess of this whole thing, right? But what I find really interesting about it is basically how they promoted this festival, right? It was entirely through social media, right? So it was one viral video, which they shot prior to the event using, the top influencers, right? So you've got like the models, Gigi Hadid, Bella Hadid, Kendall Jenner, all these huge big name celebrities who were promoting it on social media. And what they were doing is they were posting an orange square on Instagram, and they got all these top influencers to promote it. And because of the social media phenomenon, and with these people who were having millions of followers, people were buying into it, right? So of course now these influencers have all this backlash about, how could you promote such a bad event?
They were obviously being paid. They were paid.
Of course they were paid, yeah.
Money, yeah.
And then they did this video where they were flying them in and, showing them running on the beach and things like that. So what they were very clever at marketing this was, FOMO, right? FOMO, the fear of missing out.
Yeah.
For millennials, they wanted to be there. So they knew how to tap into the psyche of the millennials about, come be at this event. It's the sexiest event of the year. You can mix around and mingle with all your favorite influencers. It's going to be cool. You can Instagram it. So they were tapping into that. And the thing is, it was such a success. The event sold out within like 24, 48 hours of being sold online.
But it was it a con or not? I mean, it was just...
They didn't stage it as a fraud, right? Like, they didn't, like, go in thinking, oh, we're going to, like, cheat all these people, right?
It was really bad management.
Yeah, like, so it's just badly organized.
It was just so badly organized. But then as it snowballed, the CEO was then conning investors about getting more money in. They were conning people to pay up early. They were doing all sorts of things where people were not being paid, the workers were not being paid on the island to build the tents, for example. They were asking people to buy wristbands and put deposits into their money so that they could buy things which they didn't even have anything to buy. So, there were all these cons that they were doing to cover their tracks. So it just became worse and worse and worse.
So it's the 1MDB of festivals.
Yes, it is. Festival. Exactly.
Yeah. But exactly. You, Zafian, you're interested in the character of the...
The guy is, there's a really good documentary on Netflix where you can see a lot of insight about this guy, the CEO. He is clearly an egomaniac, a narcissist, very similar to, this other scandal that's breaking out in the U.S., the Theranos CEO, that startup girl who's doing this blood test product,
yeah.
Right? People like Jolo come to mind. I mean, these are people who are flamboyant. They were big spenders. They were living a lavish lifestyle. They were really good at talking, at getting people to give them money, right? But credibility whatsoever.
But with these kind of Ponzi schemes, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
With a lot of them, they usually start with the best of intentions, that the person who starts taking in some capital thinks that they can make money, that they can put on that festival, that 1MDB will make some money.
Yeah.
But you know, and then it runs away from them.
Exactly. I mean, to do a festival or to do an event of this scale, it takes years of planning. Right? Just to book people in, just to do the logistics of it. And the people that he had hired were telling him, you can't do this in this amount of time. Right? You cannot. There's no way you can pull this off. But because he wouldn't listen to anyone, he thought, no, he was great. Mm. Right? And when you talk about hubris, right? You know, the bigger they are, the higher they fall. I mean, he thought he could do this, and he just didn't listen to anyone.
Up till a certain point, you started believing in yourself even more. Like, it's not really... So first you just started because, okay, I just have to do it. But after a while, you started like feeding, you know, like this lies that you're feeding people started like lies, getting into you also.
Exactly, yeah.
But if he just teamed up with a good organizer.
He did. He did try. But I mean, they were advising him, but he just didn't listen.
He just didn't listen.
And they told him, let's postpone it to the following year. He didn't want to do it. He just said, let's just go ahead and do it.
But you're in the business yourself of making viral video content, which I'm not actually sure if that's entirely possible. Because, you know, unless that puppy comes along and does that cute thing at that precise moment. Then,
right.
You know. Sure. Anyway, but you would have to say, in terms of just getting the interest in this product, you'd have to take your hat off to the guy, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, from a marketing standpoint, like social media wise, I mean, the way he used the influencers and that video, I mean, it sold out the festival. I mean, it was such a phenomenon. Yeah. And
could it be done again? I mean, people are now once bitten, twice shy.
I think so. I think they'd be a lot more suspicious on any type of new festival that comes out that is on this scale because the claims were so outrageous, right? And there was just no way that they could execute it. But people bought into it. The millennials bought into it. And that's why they went. And they bought tickets.
Do you think that people can still trust influencers? Do you think they still have the same amount of influence that they had at that time?
I think influencers are still pretty powerful. And I think, you know, KOLs or influencers are still, you know, they have a strong following and a strong base. But I think now it's they're making it mandatory where, you know, you have to declare whether it's an ad. Right. So if you're doing a posting, even if it's a YouTube video or even if it's an Instagram post, you're supposed to hashtag ad, for example. Right. So that people know that this is a paid, ad that you're promoting something. Right. As opposed to, you know, making it appear like, oh, this is actually really you just liking a product, for instance. Right. So I think, you know, trust was broken. And if you look at the social media posts from the fans of these the influencers who were posting all this stuff, they got a lot of backlash. I mean, they even had to come out and apologize, right? And say, you know, sorry, we didn't know.
What, Kendall Jenner?
Yeah.
She apologized.
It was either Kendall Jenner or Bella Hadid.
Bella Hadid.
I think it's Bella Hadid,
I think Kardashians apologized for nothing.
I think it was Bella Hadid who apologized, yeah. Came out and apologized for it, yeah.
Okay, well, after this show, the three of us are going to sit down. We're going to FOMO something.
Yes.
And we'll announce it. And we're going to rake in millions. Maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud.
It's a Ponzi scheme, isn't it?
Not how a Ponzi scheme works. Okay. Lesson learned. All right. So you reckon it's going to happen again, though?
I mean, using influencers is something that a lot of businesses do, whether it's beauty products or hair products or makeup or, you know, that sort of stuff. So that's quite a normal thing that happens all the time in the whole social media space. But in terms of an event of this scale, I'm not sure. I mean, there are a lot of events that do that.
Yeah.
But this was just so outrageous. I think that's why it just caught so much media attention.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. And you can watch on
you should watch the documentary if you have Netflix. You can watch it. It's called Fire. Wow. FYRE.
And there's another one, Rahma, that you watched.
Oh, yeah. There's another one on Hulu. Like, I haven't watched it. I've been trying to watch it. I think it's called... I don't remember what is it, but it's... If you key in FYRE, then you would be able to find it. Yes.
Right. Okay, but we're going to move on now too because we're going to social media influence you people with our recommendations right now. Recommend something you think might be of interest. I'm going to go first. And my recommendation is a movie, and it's brand new. Well, brand new several months ago. I finally got around to watching it, and it's The Incredibles 2. It's fantastic. I really loved the first Incredibles, which is, 10, 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. And they finally got around to making another one. It's so good. I love it. I just loved it so much. I could watch it again.
Did you cry?
No, I don't. Well, kind of for a moment it was like, sort of, you know. But it was really, have you watched it, Rahma?
I haven't.
Did you watch the first one?
Yeah, I watched the very first one. Yes. Yeah. I liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. One of the great things about the Incredibles movie, so many of these animated movies have bad acting. I don't mean necessarily the voice actors, but when they are animated, if you turn the sound off and you just watch the movements, they animate every single word. So they're kind of like constantly just acting badly. Big eyes suddenly dashing over there, doing this. Every word. It's so tedious. Whereas with the Incredibles, Brad Bird, the director, makes them real people who just happen to be superhuman and happen to be animated.
And so the movie was a lot more subtle.
Much more subtle.
Maybe human, maybe.
Yeah.
More naturalistic.
More naturalistic. I mean, it's still, you know, cartoonish, but it's just not bad acting. So anyway, my recommendation, go watch The Incredibles 2. It's fantastic. Rahma, what's yours?
Yes. Okay. So my recommendation has something to do with what I just talked about. So I found out that property prices would fluctuate with lunar, with this full moon. And then when there's like no full moon, then it would drop. Yeah. So I was just wondering if you guys have found out if there are other things outside there that would be affected by the moon cycle.
My wife is convinced that she goes a bit crazy when there's a full moon. I don't think so. I don't think so myself. Well, one thing is that there was a group of people in Birmingham during the Industrial Revolution, Birmingham in England, who used to gather, including the likes of Charles Darwin's father and Josiah Wedgwood, etc. And they would meet up in the full moons. And they called themselves the Lunatic Society, Luna being moon.
Oh.
And the reason why they would meet in the full moon is because they could walk home with the light of the moon.
What did they talk about?
They would talk about science and philosophy, but mostly science. And they were actually very important in moving science forward at that time. And they were quite radical thinkers. And it's something that we forget is that the moon, now that we have electric lighting, the moon was very necessary for you just to be able to see something at night. Otherwise, everything stops it when the sun goes down. But when there's a full moon, then you can actually do something at night.
Yeah. And the night begins.
Yeah. Does often you got any moon type stuff in your life?
No, but I've been actually, this because of my colleagues, because of Chinese New Year, so I've been reading up a lot about Chinese feng shui, actually. And there's this thing that you can do like with on Joey Yap's website where you can actually fill in like your, he's basically automated your whole like feng shui about your life. And that's why he's so clever and why he's the most successful, you know, multi-million dollar feng shui expert in this country, where you just put in your birth date and your time of birth and it comes out with a chart, right? And about what your life and how it is and who you are and what your character is. Of course, you have to then be an expert at interpreting all this data that comes out, which I'm not. But then that's how he funnels you into his system of, if you want to know more, then you pay me more money and I'll tell you about your life and what your year is going to be like. But it's actually really fascinating. Just looking at it, and of course, you know, it's like it's all lunar based, right? So the feng shui and the positioning of, you know, where the planets are and the time of birth and where your body was at this time, you know, so all these things kind of influence who you are. It's all written in the skies, so to speak.
Okay.
So it's on his website.
Yeah.
Okay, right. We'll check it out.
I'll show it to you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. So recommendations. Think more about the moon.
Yeah.
And Zafian, what'd you got?
Probably a recommendation that I would, you know, even for myself, I think I need to apply is be bold, I think. Oh. Be bold. In terms of your personality, if you really want something, you just have to be bold to do it and get it. And I'm thinking about all these con men, right? Because they were so bold, but they were so insincere, right? So I think if you're going to be bold, be sincere and have a true intention in whatever it is that you do. And seek good people, not nice people. Because the nicest people I've met are actually the worst people.
Oh, okay.
Ooh,
all right.
That's a good advice.
A lot of contradictions as well.
That's really good advice.
Okay, so for this Lunar New Year, be bold and be sincere. I can sincerely tell you I'm not going to be bold. So otherwise, I'm on board. Okay, so that brings us neatly to the end of this week's show. And only remains me now to thank Rahma.
And my last name is?
I'm so confused in my head. Zafian Fuzi. I know Zafian Fuzi because I've known him for longer. And Rahma. It's not Palsy, is it?
It is Palsy.
You told me I got that wrong earlier. That's why I'm so confused. Okay. and myself, Cam Ruslan, I know that one. And join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.